This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with New York City attorney Nancy Stearns. Nancy's legal career includes litigating restrictive abortion laws and several high-profile civil liberties cases over the past several decades. Law professor and cryptocurrency expert Angela Walsh joins us to talk about blockchain technologies and cryptocurrencies.
Are these new cryptocurrencies just a mere piece of speculation on the financial markets, or are they actually going to help us and protect us?
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. In 1970, an unusual legal team came together in what would become a landmark case challenging New York State's restrictive abortion ban. The case was Abramowitz v. Lefkowitz, and the team consisted of all women, many of whom had just a few years of legal practice. The premise was equally unusual at the time. Its critical testimony came directly from women who had had illegal abortions, lack of contraceptive access, and painful experiences, either from adoption or forced motherhood. One of the attorneys on the case was Nancy Stearns. After the Abramowitz decision influenced the state's passage of the nation's most liberal abortion law before Roe v. Wade, Nancy would go on to bring successful challenges to abortion laws in New Jersey, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts. Nancy attended law school after working with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Atlanta. For 12 years at the Center for Constitutional Rights, she worked on a number of significant civil rights cases, including challenging New York City's mandatory pregnancy leave policy in Monell v. Department of Social Services that resulted in a Supreme Court ruling that municipalities are liable for damages under 42 U.S.C. 1983. She represented members of Vietnam Veterans Against the War in a federal criminal conspiracy prosecution arising from anti-war protests, and she litigated to reunite families separated by the baby lift, in which Vietnamese infants and young children were brought to the U.S. for adoption at the close of the Vietnam War, despite having living parents. Nancy is also an accomplished cabaret singer, making the circuit in New York City. She is a longtime member of the National Lawyers Guild. In fact, the Guild's New York City chapter is honoring her and her exemplary career at its annual Spring Fling on June 8th. We are most honored to have Nancy with us to discuss some of the many textbook-worthy cases she has brought on behalf of women and others in the tradition of people's lawyering. Nancy, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Nancy, from its outset, your legal career has been rather extraordinary. Could you tell us about your first job where you worked on two House Un-American Activities cases?
Sure. I sort of thought of myself as the community property of two different lawsuits. One was a case involving subpoenas that had been issued to people in New York, and the other was involved with subpoenas that had been issued to Dr. Jeremiah Stamler in Chicago and his nutritionist, Yolanda Hall. Stamler was a longtime friend of Arthur Kanoy's. I think perhaps they'd gone to college together. I can't remember now. But they were subpoenaed to a HUAC hearing in Chicago, and the New York people were subpoenaed, I think, to Washington. But in any event, we worked on the challenges together. Arthur had developed a bunch of cases about the chilling effect on First Amendment freedoms, Dombrowski versus Pfister. And basically what we were arguing was just to force a person before HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee, would have a chilling effect on their First Amendment freedoms, and we were trying to stop those subpoenas. Ultimately, in the Stamler case, we were trying to stop a criminal prosecution of Stamler and Hall, requiring them to testify and them refusing to testify. What I did was I compiled an appendix of the history of both attorneys and their clients appearing before HUAC, because we were trying to show that the impacts HUAC had had over the years, people having lost their jobs, people committing suicide because their lives were destroyed by merely appearing before HUAC. And in the context of that, I, not surprisingly, met large numbers of lawyers who were members of the Lawyers Guild, because those were the people who represented those witnesses.
Nancy, I must confess I'm a bit jealous that you had the chance to work so closely with Arthur Canoy. I knew him for a few years, and he was one of my heroes.
Arthur was really my mentor. I mean, there's no other way of describing it.
Yeah.
He was quite amazing.
Nancy, you then challenged New York State's abortion law. Can you briefly talk about that and how that early experience shaped your views about litigation?
Sure. First of all, my views of litigation were, I think, largely shaped by Arthur Canoy and some of the other guild lawyers who had worked in the South with the Southern Civil Rights Movement doing litigation, because often their model was not just to represent, for example, one individual who may have been prosecuted, but to get large numbers of community people, civil rights workers, to challenge some of the laws, the criminal laws that were being used to try to stop civil rights workers and the civil rights movement. And having watched that during the civil rights period, that was how I kind of approached the abortion litigation. During the summer of 69, I think it was, I had met some women who worked for HealthPAC, the Health Policy Advisory Committee, and were having meetings to talk about women's health, women's experiences with doctors, and of course one of the crucial areas of women's health was women's inability to obtain abortions. And in law school, I remember having read an article, a law review article by a wonderful lawyer named Harriet Pilpel, talking about a woman's right with respect to, a constitutional right with respect to the abortion laws, and I guess it stuck in my head. And between that and meeting these women from HealthPAC and joining some of their discussions, it occurred to me that we might be able to use some of the same kinds of techniques that Arthur and some of the other lawyers had used in the South. And we got together and started having meetings in all around New York, in the, not only Manhattan, the other boroughs. And women would gather, and there would be a doctor talking about medical aspects of abortion. There would be somebody from HealthPAC talking about women's health as a political issue. And I would talk about legal issues. And in that context, we gathered large numbers of women who decided they wanted to be part of a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of New York's abortion law. And we were lucky in that at the same time there were other lawyers with thoughts of challenging the abortion laws, but they were challenging them primarily from the perspective of doctors or abortion counselors. And there was one woman who was working for legal services who was trying to challenge the law from an economic inequality perspective. So we were able to focus really almost exclusively on the women's perspective and women's rights to abortion, as opposed to, you know, the doctor's ability to practice medicine. And that was the way we approached it.
I imagine what you did, in effect, was humanize the issue by hearing how it impacted their lives in terms of inconvenience, loss of various aspects that not being able to have an abortion would create.
Absolutely. As a result of that, we really focused on the right to liberty and how taking the right to abortion away from a woman basically took away her liberty. But we also talked about how it made her an unequal member of society and how, for example, almost all the people who were in the legislatures, the state legislatures, who were making a determination whether a woman would have a right to abortion were men, not surprisingly. And part of that went back to the fact that women couldn't even get an equal education, because if they became pregnant when they were in college or before they went to college, they might not ever finish college or start college. They wouldn't go to law school. I mean, we talked about how it impacted women's lives from the very beginning and never stopped.
I was just reading a 1981 New York Times article addressing the issue that we often forget about, of voluntary sterilization. And it talked about signs by the Association for Voluntary Sterilization that were in subway cars. And I just want to read, one of the ads said, 12 million Americans have chosen permanent birth control over all other methods. How big an issue was this in New York in the 70s, and how did you come to be involved in reforming these practices?
It was a very big issue. One of the things that we discovered was that after abortion became legal in New York, which it did around the time we started our lawsuit, I think under the pressure of the various lawsuits, potentially holding New York's law unconstitutional, the New York State Legislature did change the law in 1970, as a result of which our lawsuits never finished in court. Excuse me for a minute. But at the same time, as abortion became legal, what we found was that poor women were being pressured into agreeing to sterilization in exchange for getting an abortion in public hospitals. And a woman who was in the quality assurance division, I think she was the head of quality assurance in the New York City Health and Hospital Corporation, her name was Esther Armstrong, she became very concerned about that issue, and she formed a working group at the Health and Hospital Corporation to examine the problem and ultimately to draft guidelines to ensure informed consent, so that if a woman, for example, was approached about getting sterilized, she was given all of the information she needed, the alternatives, a real understanding of what sterilization meant, because, and I hadn't thought about this in a long time, but at that point, people talked about tying your tubes, and many people who weren't given the appropriate information thought, well, if you could tie your tubes, you could untie your tubes. That meant if you wanted a child later, you could have it, but that is not the way sterilization worked. So as a result of Esther Armstrong's forming this working group, we were able to develop guidelines to ensure informed consent for women who were going to be sterilized, and those guidelines ultimately formed the basis for the New York State guidelines and also finally for the federal guidelines to try to ensure, for example, government money wasn't going to be used to pressure women into being sterilized without really knowing what that meant and really choosing it voluntarily.
Nancy, you then worked at the Center for Constitutional Rights for several years, and I understand that you got a phone call one day from the husband of Jane Monell, who was a social worker in a small shelter for abused teens in Brooklyn. Can you tell us the story of how you then got involved in one of the most famous legal cases of all time?
Well, ironically, it ended up being famous not for the reason we started it. Yes, her husband is Oscar Chase, who I guess then was working for legal services and now is a law professor at NYU, and who actually worked in the South when I worked for SNCC, and we've stayed friendly, which is really quite lovely. Oscar called to to talk to me, I guess, and the center about whether or not we would be interested in helping him challenge the policy in the Department of Social Services compelling a woman to take maternity leave at a certain point during her pregnancy. At roughly the same time, I also got a call from another lawyer named Gregory Abbey, whose wife worked for the New York Board of Education. They had a similar policy. The policies weren't identical. They chose different points during the maternity leave during the pregnancy to force a woman to take maternity leave, but essentially it was the same thing. And I was really interested in that issue because that was another way when women's lives were really severely interfered with in a very unjustifiable and, I thought, unconstitutional way. There was other litigation proceeding on those issues in other states at that point, and I was, of course, familiar with it. So we brought a lawsuit, the center brought a lawsuit with Oscar and Gregory Abbey, the husband of the woman who worked for the Board of Education, as co-counsel, challenging the constitutionality of both sets of maternity leave policies. And during the process of the litigation, the policies were changed. But the litigation continued to try to obtain, because they were both class actions, to try to obtain damages for the women who had been compelled to take maternity leave when they were perfectly capable of working. And the fight around whether or not we could proceed to get damages ended up resulting in, you're right, a landmark case in the United States Supreme Court, which said that you could sue a municipality for damages as a result of unconstitutional practices that were city policies, that were municipality policies. And that resulted in people all across the country being able to get damages in connection with police brutality, in connection with all kinds of different municipal policies that violated people's constitutional rights.
And we should note that that Supreme Court case actually overruled Monroe v. Pape.
That's correct.
And
thank
overruling
you.
Doesn't happen that often.
That is for sure. That is for sure. By the way,
yes.
I want to make clear, I did not argue that case. And in a very funny way, I mean, we ended up having wonderful support from the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and other organizations as well. But in a very funny way, for me, the case has always been about unconstitutional policies with respect to maternity leave. But I was delighted that it ended up being so much more than that.
You have so many wonderful cases. Unfortunately, we can only highlight a few, but I was interested in the so-called Gainesville Eight. Can you talk about who they were and what came out during trial?
Sure. The Gainesville Eight were members and a couple of supporters of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War. During the 1972 Republican National Convention in Florida, these guys who were either, you know, they were all Vietnam vets, but who were either members or supporters of VVAW, the Vietnam Veterans Against the War, were subpoenaed before a grand jury in Tallahassee, basically to try to get them away from the Republican National Convention, because the federal government knew that they were planning anti-war demonstrations. It was the height of the Vietnam War. The veterans who were against the war were really crucial to the anti-war movement, and the government clearly did not want them at the Republican National Convention. So there was, in 72, there was a grand jury, and that grand jury ultimately indicted the eight either members or supporters of VVAW and charged them with conspiring to disrupt the convention with wrist rockets, slingshots, and fried marbles, amongst other things. That was sort of the heart of the indictment. And so we spent the next summer in Florida representing the vets in the criminal trial. Early on in the trial, when we were meeting with our clients, the government had given us a small room across from the courtroom that we were, trying the case. Somebody, if I remember correctly, somebody looked down on the floor. Against the wall, and said they thought they saw shoes. And we thought that was kind of odd that there was anything on the other side of the wall. And we went out and we discovered that there was a closet that contained the switching equipment for the courthouse in this closet. And lo and behold, we found a couple of FBI agents, and they were eavesdropping on our meetings with our clients. And needless to say, that caused quite a stir. We thought it should get the indictments thrown out, case thrown out. That didn't happen. It did get us a lot of press, but ultimately we won. The guys were acquitted. Oh, there was one other thing we discovered during the trial, which also should have had the case thrown out. When one of their star witnesses was put on the witness stand, it turned out that one of the major government informants was not only the best friend of the key defendant in the Gainesville 8, but that he had been my client during the grand jury. We had represented a whole bunch of witnesses in the grand jury, not only the 8 that were ultimately indicted, but others as well. And one of them, and as I say, he was my client in the grand jury, was a guy named William Lemer. And it turned out he had been a government informer all along throughout the years of the VVAW organizing in Gainesville and through the grand jury.
Well, that is really the stuff of a Hollywood film.
Oh, yes.
Which leads us into our next case. Those who saw the 1982 film Missing will be delighted to know that in 1977 you actually worked on the case Horman v. Kissinger, which charged the U.S. government for complicity in the detention and death of American journalist Charles Horman in the 73 coup d'etat in Chile. What did that case mean to you?
It had an overwhelming personal meaning to me. In legal terms, it was a tremendously important case because it was one of the early times we really started talking about international human rights in American courts. And I've got to say that the Center for Constitutional Rights and Lawyers Guild lawyer Peter Weiss was the one who really made us start thinking about international human rights in American court context. Let me step back a minute and say that the Horman family, Charlie's widow Joyce and his parents Edmund and Elizabeth Horman, came to us at the center and asked us whether we would be willing to consider suing the American government in connection with Charlie's death. Ed Horman, Charlie's father, had used the Freedom of Information Act incredibly effectively to get large numbers of documents that really raised questions about the American government involvement in his death. And the Church Committee hearings and the Church Committee report also made us really believe that the American government was involved in Charlie's death, because it really uncovered the extent to which our government was involved in the coup against Chile. And it was really very inspiring representing the Hormans, because their case was so important, and it was important to bring these kinds of facts in front of the American people. But it was also, frankly, in some ways devastating for me, because ultimately, because the government successfully challenged our ability to get at the documents we really felt we needed and the witnesses we really wanted to question, claiming national security. We ultimately had to agree to dismiss the case, though I've got to say without prejudice, because ultimately we couldn't prove what we really knew, which was that our government was deeply involved in the death of an American citizen. And it's painful when you have to face the fact that you can't do everything you feel you should be able to in the court system, and you can't truly bring justice in all situations to people who deserve it. We were really trying to get information, and we were stymied. We ultimately weren't able to get the information that we were sure was there and that we really knew the Hormans deserved.
Nancy, we're running out of time, but I can't leave you without asking about your experience teaching seminars at Rutgers Law School for 2 decades, and actually you took over the course Women in the Law when Ruth Bader Ginsburg left.
That's correct.
What advice do you have for law students and for young lawyers who may find the idea of practicing what we call people's lawyering very attractive, but still daunting, especially in light of what you just said about the Horman case?
I think, in a way, I look back to guild lawyers in the 40s and 50s, and how, despite the fact that the courts were not favorable, the congressional committees were on attack, they must have sought solace and energy from each other to keep up the fight. And really, their clients, I think, were probably what gave them the inspiration to keep up the fight, because the people, the labor movement, the various movements during the 40s and 50s were there, and they were fighting. And the lawyers were an adjunct, and that's what we've got to be. We've got to just keep coming up with new ideas. There's always new ways to challenge things. I mean, some of the things we tried in the 60s and 70s and 80s, we never reached because we were able to win on other bases. We've just got to keep going back to all of the possible ideas and come up with new ones. And it is an incredibly exciting thing to bring challenges and to win them. And sometimes you don't win, but other times you do. And it's a crucial role that we can play, so long as we remember that we're doing it with people who are activists, with people who are in various social political movements, because they're the ones who are going to give us the energy.
Attorney Nancy Stearns, you've summarized how valuable radical lawyers are, not only as a support network, but also to the community in general. In reading about your legal career, I was personally so moved and inspired by everything you've done over the years, and your many contributions to not only women's justice, but justice for everyone who incurs sort of repression at the hands of the state. So thank you, and thank you for being with us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
In 2008, Satoshi Nakamoto invented Bitcoin, the first and most prominent cryptocurrency, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system. While cryptocurrencies have become an international phenomenon, and many are aware of their importance, yet they are still not completely understood by large financial institutions, governments, and much of the public. There are currently more than 1,500 cryptocurrencies, and the list continues to grow. The general definition of cryptocurrencies are digital currencies that use encryption techniques, hence the prefix crypto, to regulate the generation of units of currency and to verify the transfer of funds. This system operates independently of a central bank to create an outlet for personal wealth beyond restriction and confiscation. The U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission recently announced that it will be requiring digital asset exchanges to register with the agency. This quickly emerging area is attracting the attention of legal scholars. Joining us to talk about cryptocurrencies is Angela Walsh. Professor Walsh teaches at St. Mary's University School of Law. Her research focuses on money in the law, blockchain technologies, governance of emerging technologies, and financial stability. She is a research fellow at the Center for Blockchain Technologies at the University College London. Welcome, Angela, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with a couple of definitions. What is blockchain technology, and then what are cryptocurrencies?
So it's hard to decide which definition to do first because they're very much interconnected. And a basic explanation of blockchain technology is that it's the technology that underlies cryptocurrencies. And the easiest way for me to explain it is to describe it really as just a big list or a big database. And what is said to be special about this list or database is that it's maintained by a group of people who work together instead of that group of people deciding to delegate responsibility for keeping the list to a single party. So the simplest way to think about this is it's group record keeping. Now, there was just an article in The Verge yesterday about how the term blockchain has kind of become meaningless because so many different variations of technology are now lumped in under this heading. And I very much think that's a fair description of what is going on. But blockchain technology emerged from the world of cryptocurrencies. It's Bitcoin was the first manifestation of it. So cryptocurrencies, I'll go into a little bit now since they are where blockchain technology comes from. And the first cryptocurrency, as I said, was Bitcoin. And Bitcoin was introduced to the world through a white paper in late 2008, right in the throes of the financial crisis. And then the software was released in early 2009. And amazingly, we still don't know who actually gave us the white paper or the software. The person or group of people who created it has gone by the pseudonym Satoshi Nakamoto ever since, so it's still a mystery. And what Bitcoin is again, simply a list or a database, a way of keeping track of things, a record-keeping system. And the software that was released is run on a whole bunch of computers all around the world. The software was made freely available. It's open source software, so anyone can choose to download the software and begin to run it. And for that reason, this type of system is often known as an open system, a public system, sometimes called a permissionless system. You don't have to get permission to join this network. And what this network of computers does is it essentially maintains the list. So if new entries need to be made to it, the computer network validates those entries and then adds them to the list. Okay? And so the computer network that I've been referring to here, they're sometimes called nodes in the network, and ones that perform a particular task are called miners. And the miners are called that because, right, they're doing all the work, essentially, of validating and maintaining this record. And in exchange for that, the system was set up initially such that they would get paid for that. And the way they get paid is by the generation of new bitcoins, essentially. So whichever miner in this network of computers is the first to validate the transaction. They essentially win new bitcoins. And what are bitcoins? They're something that's just made up within the system. At the beginning, it was decided, you know, this is how the system is going to be funded, and it was described initially as intended to function as like a peer-to-peer electronic cash that you didn't have to go through a central corrupt party like a government. You could do it outside the government system altogether. So bitcoins are just made up, and the list is used to keep track of these made-up things called bitcoins.
When you talk about the list, Angela, do you mean a list of owners of the currency?
That's a great question. So it's essentially a list of how these bitcoins are changing hands. And what you get when you have your, it's almost like your password, but it's called your private key. Your private key gives you the ability to make decisions about this line on the list that represents your bitcoins. Okay, so you can say, I am choosing to send either this full amount that I have on the line on the list or a portion of that to someone else. And my private key is what I use to validate that I have control over those bitcoins.
But where does the value of the bitcoin or cryptocurrency come from?
Again, a great question, and one to which there's no easy answer. What's really interesting about these systems is that they make you ask those fundamental questions about where does their value come from, but where do any ideas of value come from, right? Why do we ascribe value to the U.S. dollar or the euro or any or gold or anything else? And I think it ultimately boils down to we choose to. A bunch of people in the world have decided to ascribe value to bitcoins and these various different cryptocurrencies, just like we have decided that the U.S. dollar is worth something. So it's, you also get into questions about, you know, well, doesn't gold or something have some sort of intrinsic value because you can use it potentially for other things, and people have thought for many, you know, thousands of years that gold is just worth something. You're forced to grapple with those kinds of questions too. And in the end, you know, after wrestling with this for a number of years, I've kind of come to the place where I'm very skeptical of any claims of intrinsic value, and I think they're really just socially, you know, generated ideas here that we have about value.
You know, I wrestled with the question, too, and I want to go back all the way to Adam Smith, who I believe said that labor was the source of value. And I think Karl Marx said the same thing. And if you talk about gold, labor goes into mining gold, so it gives it some value. But Bitcoin seemed to me to something that's just pulled out of the ether.
Well, so those are great references there, and they are often part of the discussion in this space. So a lot of people call Bitcoin digital gold because, you know, gold is said to have these particular attributes. It's divisible, right? You can cut it up into a whole bunch of different coins. It's going to endure over time. It's not easy to destroy with weather. It doesn't decay. It's very durable, right? And the proponents of cryptocurrency say that, wow, well, things like Bitcoin have all those same characteristics as well. They're going to endure for a long time, assuming that the, of course, you have to make the assumption that the network of computers will endure for a long time. One of the important characteristics of Bitcoin that I didn't mention yet was that the creator explicitly coded into the software that there would only be a finite amount of Bitcoin ever to be created, at least under the code as currently drafted, that there would only be 21 million units of Bitcoin, right? And so that's analogized to gold because gold, you know, there's a kind of a finite supply of gold as well. We occasionally discover new, right, pockets of gold, but it's not like people can just make up gold. So the idea is that you can't make up Bitcoin, right? Once it was created at the beginning, there was going to be this finite supply. A lot of people see Bitcoin having, because of its, they call it like, you know, it's scarcity. It's guaranteed scarcity. They see it as analogous to gold and deriving value from that.
It's interesting. I'm thinking that to engage in purchasing or trading cryptocurrency, you have to have internet access.
Yes. Yes, that's kind of a fundamental, yes.
And I understand, I read an estimate that there may be about 3 million cryptocurrency users now, which is 0.14% of the 2.1 billion people around the globe who have internet access. What happens if that number increases dramatically? Does the value go up of cryptocurrency as more people engage in its mining and trading?
Yeah, so there's lots of different predictions going on about this. So there's, I think, very much tied to this conversation about internet access is that a lot of people are making predictions that, you know, within, you know, not too long, it will be possible for everyone to have a smartphone and Wi-Fi. And if everyone has this and everyone can participate in a new way in the kind of global digital economy, and they see cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin or potentially others, being a really important part of this. So one of the reasons I think that proponents, early adopters of Bitcoin talk about this, they see that they predict that, wow, all of a sudden everyone is going to have the realization that this is the way of the future, right? That Bitcoin is superior in many ways to our government-issued currencies, and everyone's going to want to jump on the bandwagon all of a sudden. And for that reason, there's a lot of people who own Bitcoin who don't trade it, don't use it, don't spend it, but they just buy it and hold it. And they're doing so in the expectation that it's, at some point in the future, there'll be this tipping point where everyone will want it, and the demand will be so great that, you know, the value will just skyrocket to these insane amounts. So they're kind of preparing for that moment. And that's sometimes called hyper-Bitcoinization, right? That tipping point where Bitcoin is just ubiquitous.
That's a scary concept to me. It's about the whole speculative economy we're living in. But why, Angela, why should our listeners care about this? How will they be impacted by it at some point? Its use came about after the great crash of 2008 when so much value was just destroyed. Mm-hmm. People are predicting that because the economic system is a cyclical one and these crashes happen every so often, that another one's going to happen. How does Bitcoin fit into all of this? Why should we care about it?
I think it's actually really important, and I think just this past year, the developments that we've seen in the space have made it much more important. And I say that because the awareness of Bitcoin and the types of people who are investing in it and the financial products that are being created based on it are, there's just been dramatic change, okay? So at the beginning, as I talked about earlier, you know, with Bitcoin was initially designed to kind of sit outside of the reach of governments, right? It was supposed to be an alternative system. So the initial investors and participants in the space were ideologically driven, right? Purchasing Bitcoin was part of your way to say, you know, I'm anti-government, I'm coming up with a new way of doing things. Well, that's changed this year because there's been a lot of investors who are just, you know, mom and pop, people from, you know, the Main Street, Wall Street, whatever, that whole conversation. There's been Main Street investors. There's also been Wall Street investors, right? There's been a huge number of hedge funds created in the past year, more than 100 in the last numbers that I saw, to invest in cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin. Futures products. Bitcoin futures are now trading on several commodities exchanges. And there's been a lot of exchange-traded funds based on cryptocurrencies proposed. The SEC hasn't approved those yet, but people are like waiting at the door, right? They're chomping at the bit, ready for this to keep going forward. And so I think that becomes relevant to the rest of the world, even if you are not an investor in this space, it becomes relevant because Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies are becoming integrated into the financial system, the mainstream financial system, in ways that they previously weren't. And that, to me, means that their risks, which are very poorly understood, these are very immature systems, and people we don't understand them yet. They haven't been around that long. So all of those risks are being kind of distributed into the financial system with each new financial product. So that makes me a little nervous. The central banks of the world and prudential regulators are becoming more aware of this, and I think we're seeing more and more discussions at that high level about potential systemic risks.
What kind of threat, then, does the government present to these currencies? Is there going to be more of a mainstreaming, do you think, which defeats really the original purpose?
Right. So there is a lot of action right now on this very question. So, of course, as these cryptocurrencies have become more attractive, more mainstream, that means that the government needs to pay more attention to them. And we've seen that with, you know, the Senate Banking Committee holding hearings with the heads of the SEC and the CFTC in February, and just a lot of discussion from regulators about what are we going to do. The SEC came out with some guidance yesterday that exchanges who are trading these cryptocurrencies or tokens may need to register with them, and they historically have not. So I think that government is actually a major, could be a major issue for the cryptocurrencies. Not that they can't necessarily continue to exist, right, because their proponents talk about how they are decentralized organizations, meaning you can't just lop off the head and expect the whole thing to die, right? They're peer-to-peer systems, so as long as people are willing to keep running the software somewhere, the system can keep going, right? But you can really limit, governments do have the ability, I think, to greatly limit its success, to make it uncomfortable for anyone who wants to have a legitimate business or to engage with the mainstream world to actually participate in those systems. So if they decide they are super problematic, I think there are ways that they could really reduce their use. Now, this is all complicated, I think, by the fact that we started out talking about blockchain technology. And blockchain technology is this whole, way of keeping a list as a group, has been become the ultimate buzzword and hyped technology over the last few years. And it's almost to the point where governments are just reciting as if it's, part of, just something you have to say. Bitcoin may be a problem, but blockchain technology is transformative and is going to change the way we're going to do every form of record keeping, and thus change and improve every single field and practice in the world. So there's this tension here between, are they going to go after cryptocurrencies? Can they do that at the same time they are, encouraging innovation in the blockchain technology space? So fascinating to watch right now.
Yes, and Angela, we just have a few minutes remaining, but isn't the whole crux of cryptocurrency and blockchain that it's anonymous?
I'm glad you asked that. It's actually kind of a myth that it's anonymous. And the reason that I say that is, the reason people say that it's anonymous is because when you engage in using Bitcoin, if you use it directly, like send it directly peer-to-peer through the actual Bitcoin system, as opposed to going through an intermediary like an exchange that sits on top of the system, you don't have to give your name or anything anywhere. All that you are providing essentially is your IP address, right? So it's anonymous in that way. However, IP addresses are not fully anonymous, right? Governments, law enforcement has demonstrated that they have ways of tracing people. Like, all you have to do is slip up once, essentially, and they've been able to find people who are using Bitcoin. So they found the guy who was running Silk Road, Ross Ulbricht.
Right.
Right.
And we've had his mother on the show.
Ago.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. So it's a myth that it's fully anonymous, and I think that actually law enforcement sees the fact that this is an ever-growing list of every transaction that's ever happened is potentially something that's actually very helpful for identifying problematic, you know, illegal behaviors. So don't count on it being anonymous, I would just say.
I know lots of listeners are wondering, how do I buy Bitcoin or Ethereum or another
wondering that, but can I take a Bitcoin to the grocery store, the car dealership, or my landlady? I'm trying to wrap my head around this.
Right. Okay. So I've mentioned a few times these exchanges, right? So there are a number of exchanges that have grown up in the past, you know, 5 years or so as Bitcoin has been developing. And so an example in the U.S., Coinbase is the dominant one in the U.S., and there are exchanges all over the world, basically. And what you do with those exchanges is you give them your fiat currency, right, your dollars or your euros or whatever, and they will give you bitcoins, right? So that's how people access the systems. And there's been a big range of behaviors by exchanges in the sense of, you know, how compliant they are or how much information they collect from people who they are dealing with, their customers, right? Do you have to tell them your name, your address, and all this other, like, know your customer type information when you access your bitcoins? Some are stricter than others. But again, I think there's been strong signals just in the past, even just this past week, that exchanges better get it together, right? That the regulators are coming. If you want to actually, then what do you do once you have this Bitcoin, if you've gotten one from an exchange? Well, right, it's just when you have a Bitcoin, all you have is your, essentially your private key for it, these long string of numbers, okay? And where do you spend it? So a lot of people want to hold it because they think it's going to be worth more in the future. But there are places that accept Bitcoin in payment for different things. So Overstock.com was one of the first ones. Various businesses, like I think Dell did for a while. I think Expedia either did or may still. But the interesting thing is those businesses don't really accept Bitcoin in that they don't actually ever let Bitcoin touch their own accounts. There are intermediaries called payment processors that essentially do that on their behalf, right? So they act as a middleman to accept the Bitcoin and then just give the merchant the dollars or euros or whatever it is. As the value of Bitcoin has skyrocketed and then been so volatile over the past year, there's been less adoption by merchants because people just want to hold it. You're crazy to spend it if you think the value is going to go up.
I hope somebody gives me a Bitcoin for my birthday.
Your mind or what?
We have a lot to digest. This is our primer and our listeners' primer on cryptocurrencies. We've really enjoyed your patience with us in this overview. Is there anything we've missed before we let you go that you think is important for listeners to know?
One thing I would say is that, you know, I've talked about how you would access, how would you get these cryptocurrencies. By telling you that, I don't want anyone to think that I'm encouraging people to buy them. They are very much high-risk financial products at the moment. So be very careful and do a ton of research, I would say, before you get in to make sure that you understand what you're actually getting into. And there is a lot of bad information out there, a lot of very misleading information out there, stuff that overstates the capabilities of these systems. So Go to it with a skeptical mindset, I would say.
Well, and I can ask you this. Think you could lend me $5 till Friday?
$5 till Friday? I think I could do that, yeah.
Angela, it's really been a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. Going forward, as things develop, we hope that you'll join us again.
Thank you so much. It was really great to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you, Angela. You take it easy.
Take care.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.